You are listening to Mr. Apex Podcast. We love MotoGP. Hello and welcome to Mr. Apex MotoGP Podcast. This is a show put together by MotoGP fans pretending to be experts. We aim to have a race review show ready for a midweek commute. We may not be bike races, but we love it. I am your host, Kyle Power, and today I'm joined in the virtual shed by some fellow MotoGP enthusiasts. We have now the part of the furniture who's here all the time, Jules Seegers. How's it going, Jules?
Hi, Carl. Really excited to talk about the Portuguese race. A lot of talking points, so let's get to it.
Awesome. We have also the returning and very northern Danny Henney. How's it going, Danny?
I'm good, thanks, Kyle. Glad to be back again for a show to have a good chat about the race at the weekend.
Awesome. And we also have the blast blowing, the illustrious Matt Trumpet. How's it going, Matt?
I am delighted to be here. I can't believe you invited me on for the chaos race.
Excellent. Well, without further ado, we'll go into the weekend. So the Portuguese Grand Prix, and going into this race, Bagnaia has cemented himself at the top of the standings already after round one on 39 points with a good 10-point lead over Brad Binder. So he's looking very strong. It's looking like we're going to get some samey-samey. But wow, guys, we had an awesome weekend. We had a much more exciting race and so many talking points for this race. I'm really excited to get into it. So in practice and quali, that's quite interesting for me because it's looking like we could be talking about this man a lot this weekend. It's not Pedro Acosta, it's Marc Marquez. He's finally getting a bit more confident on the Ducati and starting to push. And it's like the Marquez of old is coming back. He's started spending a fair amount of time on the deck. Now, Jules, were you surprised to see him start crashing like this? Because I was semi sort of predicting it as soon as he got sort of comfortable, but I didn't expect him to hit the deck three times.
Yeah, and actually with the race warm-up added to it, he actually hit the ground four times this weekend. But during practice and quali, he did, which was a bit of a shame because it hampered his grid position. But it didn't stop him from having a very very entertaining race on the Sunday. But to me, I thought the guy of practice and especially quali was Maverick Vinales.
Yeah, Maverick Vinales looked really good, to be fair. He looked fast all weekend. Looked like he was going to be there in the race to challenge for it. But just skipping back to the Marc Marquez, as you say, it was a bit strange to see him in Qatar quite reserved. But yeah, once you start seeing him at the deck, you know, he's starting to push. And I think like Jules said, it did hurt him a little bit because I think he would have been in with a better shot of the race win come Sunday if he hadn't have had those crashes, because I think it just put a bit of a lack of confidence in him when he come to push during the race.
Yeah, and some of them were quite unusual crashes. So he had one, I think the one he had in warm-up, he said he slipped off the foot peg and was cruising and crashed because of that way. And the one he had in qualifying is bizarre. He activated his rear ride height device way too early, almost on the entry to the final corner, and just flew off the track. And that, to me, just says that he's not really riding purely natural or on instinct, because he's kind of riding procedurally and he's trying to obviously think about it too much. And why he'd activated there, I do not know. It was way too early. So I think he's just gaffed. But he didn't say it was like some weird thing. I think he's kind of held his hands up and just say, yeah, he screwed up and activated too early, Jules.
Yeah, he fairly owned up to it. Like, yeah, I just pushed it. And it was just a mistimed. Which is odd for a rider of his caliber, but more than odd, it was a real pity, because if you saw the pace he had during practice and during the quali, it was really good, and he was looking a lot more comfortable than the riders you would expect up front, like Jorge Martin and also Pecco Bagnaia, who really seemed to struggle during the Friday and Saturday to get a ride balance in his bike.
Yeah, very good point, Matt.
See, I'm coming at this from a different angle. Like, I get that for his overall positioning, it was probably not optimal for him to be crashing there. But I will be honest and say that for all of these sports, the amount of button twiddling the riders and drivers have to do, it's pretty severe. It's a pretty severe extra load on them, and switching to an entirely different manufacturer, you'd expect a fairly long learning curve. The fact that he can be this competitive when he's still having to think, okay, I need to press the button now or later and not now, that he can be this close already is nothing but a good sign for him and a bad sign for his rivals for that other Ducati seat.
It is, yeah. I think that's something what I took away from it was he's proving that no matter how good you are, how many races you've won or how many championships, you still need to learn what the bike is going to do underneath you. And there is always something you can find out when you're in a session.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, to further expand on that, it just shows that he's not riding naturally yet at all, and he's not riding on his instincts. And he's kind of alluded to this, and this kind of concerns Pedro Acosta and how good he's been. And we will be talking a lot about him during this episode, because he pointed out, I think it was Mark Marquez made the comment that Acosta doesn't have any sort of habits or bad habits yet. He's not used to riding another bike. So all this is completely new. Acosta's learning all of these systems to do, but is learning them from a fresh sort of start point. Whereas Marquez keeps saying that when he kind of switches his brain off and is riding by instinct, his instinct is still the Honda instinct. So he's still finding himself doing stuff on the Honda and trying to ride the Ducati like a Honda, but that will gradually go away. So the fact that he's so competitive already on last year's Ducati, may I add as well, which is quite astonishing, really. But it wasn't the Ducati on pole. It was the return of the beast. Bastianini gets pole, which is really nice to see him do, particularly at the track that he was badly hurt last year, which completely scuppered his whole season. So that was a mighty, mighty performance. And yeah, a rogue Aprilia come out of nowhere, because we're not really used to Maverick Vinales, well, in recent times, being up the front of the grid on the Aprilia. So it's absolutely lovely to see. So I agree with what Jules said earlier. I think the Marc Marquez crash, having to push him down to P8, I think he probably would have been on the front row. We may have got some very different races if that was the case. But that was fascinating. So really, really fascinating practice and quali. One person we haven't mentioned yet for quali is Acosta. And yeah, he just scraped through, Jules. Like, he didn't really set practice or the world alike quite like he did in Qatar this round, but it shows maybe he was more focused on the race.
Could be. And also, of course, he had prior to the Qatar Grand Prix, he had the test sessions there already. So people were also wondering, like, okay, how can he manage himself on the MotoGP bike on a track that he didn't ride the MotoGP bike before? So he was less out there, less spotlight times that he set. And he actually only just made it into Q2 as the very last rider to do so. So and that was a really important part of the weekend for him, because if he had been stuck in Q1, he would not have eventually had the grid position that he took later on, and that enabled him to have the race he did on the Sunday.
I just want to give a shout out actually to a bit of a surprising qualifying. I thought the Yamahas, they actually looked not too bad. They weren't languishing right at the back for once. Quartararo looked quite good. Obviously a bit different when it comes to the races, but actually out of qualifying, I thought that was the shock for me, that they actually looked quite competitive for once.
That is a very good point, and that completely reminds me about a point I wanted to make for this that I had just forgotten about. So yeah, it's good to see the Yamahas up there, and it wasn't just one of them, Quartararo, it was Rins as well. He was up there sort of matching it, so they're both looking quite good. But one of the standouts, if you just look at the timing sheets, it's glaring. The bottom four positions were all Hondas. That's shocking. It looked like they were making progress. And we even on our preseason show were saying, are Honda finally making progress? The bike looks radically different. But there was three of them. There was Zarco, Mir, and Nakagami all on a 39 flat. And then a further half a second back was Marini, who's in a whole world of despair on his own, hanging off the back of the grid there. He looks completely lost. And that is a shocker from Honda, Matt.
Well, I have a theory about this. And the person that I would absolutely blame for this would be Marquez. Because I get the feeling he's, if you'll pardon a Formula One comparison, he's very Schumacher-like in that he will drive around the problem that other drivers will identify. You know, he'll drive around with understeer or oversteer or with a massive loss of downforce in a corner, and he'll run the same times. And then someone else will come in and say, yeah, you know, he broke it. And they'll look at it and say, oh, you've got a broken front axle. How did you do that time? He's like, I don't know, and just drove the car. And I feel like Honda has gotten into, and especially as they fell out of competition, really catering to Marquez really, I've used the word really twice now, sorry about that, peculiar and unique taste in how to make a bike go fast. And that's why he was able to be competitive in certain situations last season. But it's left them with a much bigger puzzle to solve this season.
That is a great point. And yeah, I totally agree. And we've seen this previously as well. Back in 2007, when it went to the 800 era and Casey Stoner won his first title with the Caddy, no one else could ride it. His teammate was Marco Melandri, a multiple 250 world champion and multiple MotoGP race winner. He was last. As Stoner was winning the races and championship, Melandri was mainly running around in last because he couldn't ride it. Stoner was riding around the problems of the Ducati, and he kept riding around the problems, and they went into the absolute doldrums for years after this. And we could call it, it's a Stoner syndrome, it's your number one rider syndrome, or your Marc Marquez syndrome, but this is exactly what Honda, and that is very right for you to point out, Matt, that seems exactly what Honda is suffering from now, Danny.
It's a common trend with top drivers, riders, though, isn't it? You'll see the true top riders and great will drive around anything that they can or ride around it, and they will actually outperform the machinery what they're on. And it's not uncommon to see that the second rider is miles off. Great example was Stoner. The only one I can think of where actually they had two top riders and it was close was probably Rossi and Lorenzo at Yamaha. There didn't seem to be a big difference despite having slightly different riding styles, but usually, yeah, you'll see the top rider out front by miles and the second rider just cannot cope with how they want to ride the bike.
Absolutely. And talking of uncommon things, let's get on and talk about that Maverick Vinales win in the sprint. So then, on to the sprint. And wow, that was a great, great race we had, particularly the first few laps of these sprints. In Formula One, I've been quite outspoken. I hate the sprint concept, and I don't think it fits at all. I've warmed to it in MotoGP. It really does seem to fit, especially in this new era where of the aerodynamics and the tendency to the field to spread a bit and then looking after the front tire pressures. The first couple of laps of the sprint races are absolutely electric, Matt.
Yeah, well, the thing that I like about it versus the Formula One concept, which is, you know, obviously kind of borrowed from it and seems to be a good value for track goers, so we'll get that out of the way, is that it works in MotoGP because you get wildly different results than you do from the actual Grand Prix the next day, meaning that there's enough variability in performance that you can have a bike that does, that you can do, that you know you can do well in the sprint on because you only have to keep the tires for 12. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I think they were running different tires in the sprint. I think the hard was both days, but they swapped from soft to medium, basically everybody, right?
Yeah, it was the rear. I believe they were all hard front and everyone ran a soft rear, I believe, in the sprint. Quartararo maybe ran a medium, I think, but I think he changed to the soft at the last minute. But everyone in the main Grand Prix were running the medium. And it was funny that because Jorge Martin said he's got the opposite way round this year, that he was struggling. It was legend in the sprints last year, but he was struggling in the sprint this year. He was struggling on the soft tyre, but he knew once he got the medium tyre on, he'd be much, much stronger in the race. So yeah, that's a very good point, Matt. That's maybe why, yeah, we do get two different things and two different tyre choices. So I'm really warming to this sprint concept in MotoGP. And the first few laps, it was so weird because talk about uncommon things. Maverick Vinales being that aggressive and fighty, which nobody expects normally. You could hear the surprise in Neil Hodgson's voice in the commentary. It was brilliant. It was just like, who is this? He was like, this isn't Maverick. And everyone has said for years, if Maverick just get away and actually get his elbows out a bit, he's always had great late race pace. So that was absolutely mega. But yeah, so seeing a fighty Maverick Vinales going up against a very fighty Marc Marquez trying to get up from the eighth place grid slot, that move that Marquez put on him on the first lap around the outside, I leapt off the sofa. I was levitating almost. I thought that was going to be a huge, huge crash. Was anyone else thinking exactly the same, Danny?
Yeah, well, like you say, when he pulled it, it looked like he was going to be on. Then on the exit, it looked like Vinales had got quite a good run. And then to stick it around the outside and go to the next corner, I think that was when you thought, he's got a bit of confidence on this bike now. He's going to start pushing on. I actually had him to win the race at that point. I just thought he looked like he'd got the pace. He'd got on top of it pretty quick. The only thing, who else was being quite aggressive and gone for the early break was Bagnaia as well. That was a bit of a shock that, you know, Mr. Smooth sat there waiting. Usually he was kind of off the line, gone for it, trying to get past people. And I think potentially probably 40. You could see the riders behind him and knew they were going to be pushing early on to try and get to the front.
Yeah, we did see that in Qatar, though, in the actual Grand Prix. Bagnaia pushed to the front and got there. It was really quite aggressive to get to the front because he wanted to be at the front, Matt.
Yeah, and this is something that I'm going to spoil your results, obviously, by jumping ahead a little bit. But if we look at how this wound up turning out, I just wonder if that Ducati wasn't really entirely to his liking the entire weekend. Because if I have a bike that I know I'm not super comfortable on, the best thing I can do is try and get out in front early and hope that people behind me spend more time fighting with each other than chasing me. And looking at that late mistake that he made, and then looking at his performance the next day in the race, I'm like, yeah, I don't think Ducati nailed it. Like, they said this bike is so much better, but I wonder if maybe they've made a narrower performance window for themselves.
Maybe, because that's odd, because they have said, and Bagnaia said this himself, it's better everywhere. He just said it's better everywhere than the 23 bike. But one comment he made about that late race mistake, and you could see it happening as soon as he crests the hill, that's going into a really tricky braking zone where the rear wheel gets light, you're trying to downshift. But an interesting comment he made, he said he hadn't considered the fuel consumption, and it was something that he should have considered. So I think he was actually rolling a little bit early because he's probably noticed he was quite close to his fuel numbers, his limits, and then braked as normal. And he actually said he wasn't pushing. It wasn't a last lapse of concentration. He wasn't particularly over the limit. He was just trying to be consistent. But I think on that lap, which he hadn't really tried in any other races, that he'd actually happened to roll and he hadn't considered this. And that's why he just lost, the rear came up a little bit more on him and it landed sideways and he had to go wide.
Yeah, and I think that's probably a sign when, like Matt said, you're not comfortable on the bike and you're not happy with the balance and you're minding other things than simplistic stuff like, yeah, your tank is emptying. And yeah, that of course he knows that affects the behavior of the bike, but he just didn't seem in the zone all weekend. And Gigi Dall'Igna also said on Tuesday after the Grand Prix that he lacked the balance pretty much all weekend. And actually his good run during the sprint was like, where did this come from? We don't understand why it's working at this point. So it was an off weekend for him. But replying to Matt, I think the bike still is very impressive. If you see what Enea Bastianini did this weekend, I think they shouldn't worry too much.
Just going back to the mistake, though, obviously, we only know from our own preferences, Carl, when we've been racing, how easy is it to make a mistake when you do back off? Ironically, when you're absolutely on the limit,
yeah.
I find it you're consistent, you're focused, you hit your marks lap after lap after lap. Obviously, we're nowhere near the level what the riders are doing, but the principle is the same. When you're focused, you don't really make mistakes. The minute you back it off and think, I'll just brake a little bit easier, I'll take a bit lighter going into the braking zone, it's actually amazing how many times you miss your braking point because you are coming in a bit slower and I suppose a little less focused, thinking of other things. And yeah, that was a clear evident of what Bagnaia did. So I actually thought he was pushing to the limit. So it's interesting to hear that, you know, he did say that actually he was taking it quite easy in there and made a mistake through that.
Yeah, that is interesting. Like, I don't think he was dawdling. I think he was pushing on quite hard, but he wasn't over the limit. He was just concentrating on everything, trying to hit all of his marks. And yeah, Matt, we've seen this in multiple different racing disciplines at all levels, that almost incomprehensible mistakes when someone's out in the lead. I mean, he wasn't streaking away with it. He had a semi-healthy lead by MotoGP standards. But it's not uncommon to see these sort of mistakes.
Yeah, and we were enjoying Vinales chasing him down and seeing the differing performance between the Aprilia and the Ducati. But I do wonder, you know, talking about the difference in aero philosophy, that maybe, oh, if I'm close to my fuel numbers and I have to lift and coast a little bit here to save some fuel to make sure I don't get on the wrong side of it, well, then that means that the amount of aero on your bike is different when you get to that same braking point. You're not moving as fast. You have slightly less downforce on the bike. So when you grab that brake, you don't have the same amount of stick to the tarmac that you would when you were fully on throttle and then immediately on brake.
Absolutely. And to add to that as well, with the different engine mapping settings they can use, it can also affect the engine braking that you get as well. So you might have a little bit more engine braking going in there, which obviously helps the wheel lock up when it lands. It will go a bit more sideways. So yeah, an uncharacteristic mistake, shall we say, from Bagnaia. But that opened the way for Vinales to go and snatch a win on the Aprilia, which is brilliant. And it depends if you count a sprint win as a full-on win. I mean, I kind of do, but he's the first rider to win on three different manufacturers in the four-stroke era. So obviously he won his first race on the Suzuki, which is Silverstone, I believe. Then obviously on the Yamaha, and that was just one of the Aprilia. So Danny, that's pretty impressive.
Yeah, he had a really solid result. And I have to say, I think Vinales needed that, because if you look back at Aprilia over the last couple of rounds, you know, start of this season, last season, all the talk was about Spargaro. You know, momentum was starting to build in his corner. Vinales was kind of getting left behind. I think his Yamaha career obviously didn't do him much credit. Very good at the start, but, you know, certainly tailed off and was kind of in nowhere towards the end of it. But I think it was really pleasing to see him. He seems a nice enough guy. Clearly, he's got a few demons in life away from the track, but yeah, it was positive to see him come there, get a solid result. And like I say, he needed that to fight back against Espargaro.
Yeah, it was really good to see that, because in the opening race in Qatar, it was all about Espargaro, because he was up there with the top positions, and Vinales wasn't anywhere around. And you'd almost forget that this guy is only 2 years older than Pecco Bagnaia. And he still has a lot of years ahead of him. And what Danny referred to, the Yamaha years, when he came to the Yamaha factory team to replace no one less than Jorge Lorenzo, he won, I think, three out of his first five races. So yeah, that was really promising. But then somehow it all faded, and he's been with Aprilia now. And it was almost like people were writing him off and talking about him like he was some kind of old dude. But, you know, he could still bring a lot to do to the table, especially if you hear him talk about this Aprilia.
Well, one of the things I love about being fairly new to watching this sport closely, as opposed to occasionally hearing about it in the background, is that I'd heard Vinales' name for years. But the main reason I knew him was the controversy about the end of his Yamaha ridership. And the media is the media, and things are things. But I always like it when someone who has been, you know, had that those sorts of aspersions cast upon them can manage to rally and get a decent result for themselves. It was really, I mean, just for Aprilia in general, I really enjoyed that a lot. But if I can point out somebody else, I think Jack Miller kind of fell into that category after the beginning of the season, because, man, he was nowhere in the first race. But this race, he was like, he at least looked like he belonged to KTM.
That is a very good shout, because, yeah, he had a shocking Qatar and he was getting beaten up left, right and center. And for this sprint, he actually got the whole shot. He actually managed to get the whole shot after Vinales went a bit wide, and then he starts getting beaten up again. But it's really important for Miller, particularly as he has a Costa on the Gas, which isn't a KTM, essentially the KTM B team. Miller's going to be under pressure, but he put in a really nice, solid result. And especially because the team, well, the kind of the de facto team leader now, who was second in the championship, Brad Binder, makes a very rare mistake and actually bins it, which was shocking, really, because he was the closest to Bagnaia in the championship at this point. So he's gone down, and, you know, we kind of expected to be Miller when the KTM goes down. It's horrible to say because I'm a big Jack Miller fan, but he has not had a great couple of races and some great runs. So it was amazing that Binder binned it, essentially, Danny.
Yeah, and I think that's going to be probably the teammate battle of the season for me. I think they're arguably the closest pairing on the grid. I know some people have some different views, but I think when they're performing, obviously Miller's a bit more hit and miss, but when they're performing, I think they're quite close on it. But I would give it to Binder from probably a talent point of view, even though I am a big Miller fan. But yeah, Binder in the deck, I think that was a bit of a... Miller's got to make the most of that. He's got to try and get the points, and he's got to try and get a bit of a psychological advantage from it. And all he needs to do, bless him, is stay on the bike, because it was nice to see him not hit the deck himself for once.
Absolutely. And so coming to the end of the sprint race, then there's one more sort of major talking point in this, and that was Marc Marquez hunting down Jorge Martin on the last lap. And, well, this was pretty much a dressed rehearsal for what was going to happen on the Sunday. It's the same corner. He has a lunge from quite far back, gets it stopped, a very rude move, and lifts Jorge Martin up. Thinking back to, like, the first or second lap, Martin does the same to Marquez, to be fair. He puts a really tough move on him. But Marquez, as we've said numerous times, he gives as good as he gets, and he doesn't really mind this sort of shrug. And Martin's a tough pedaler as well, so he wouldn't have been too upset by that. So Marquez snatches second on the final lap from Martin. And again, for Martin, this is bad. He doesn't want that 23 Ducati with Marquez on ahead of him. He's on the 24 bike, and he's really wanted to, you know, cement himself, because I'm going to be the big challenger to Pecco Bagnaia here. He doesn't want Marquez in things. So already Jules start, you know, he would have been gutted to see Marquez mug him essentially on the last lap.
Yeah, and the sprint race was hinting at trouble for Jorge. If you see how Marc Marquez did a move on him, Marc Marquez overtook Vinales as well during the sprint, and it was only due to Marc going wide at a certain point that allowed Vinales to overtake him. The result of the sprint race could have been a lot different, because it would have been Marc in P2 when Pecco would make his mistake. So yeah, it's a very, very tasty and promising outlook for what is to come.
So I love that Jules has said that, because the evidence to me is, well, once Vinales was in front, Marquez did not catch him. I'm thinking that Aprilia had some performance characteristics on those tires that might not have guaranteed Marquez crossing the line first if he'd been in front when Bagnaia went off. But the point I also want to make, and yeah, it's just a tiny one here, is that I watched the last race of last season, and I see Martin fighting Marquez and choosing to finish third, and I see Bagnaia in the future maybe not making such a smart choice.
Daddy.
Can I just say very quickly, can we just remember, though, if Marquez hadn't made that mistake down into the hairpin, he would have won the race, because he was actually up at the front then, weren't he, I think, going. And without that mistake, he'd have been in front when Bagnaia went off, and he'd have probably pulled away and won the race. So just to throw it out there, I know he had a bit of a up and down race, but, you know, there was someone else in it as well. Vinales did a great result, but I think without that mistake, yeah, Marquez could have gone for it as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very similar to what Jules said. Yeah, I wasn't lost on me. I was like, because when he made the mistake, I think it's into turn five down there. It was the turn that they put the move on Jorge Martin, and the turn that where they have the clash later on. And talking about later on, I think that's about, we can't talk too much more about the sprint, because we have a rip snorter of a Grand Prix review to get through. So on to the main Grand Prix review, and guys, what a race. We've got some main sort of talking points that I'd like to break it down into that we can focus on. So we've obviously got the Vinales heartbreak, amazing Acosta, the dominant Martin, and I don't think anything else happened, did it? I don't think we've got anything more to talk about. Oh no, of course, we will finish on Bagnaia versus Marquez and have a game of whose fault is it. But I'd just like to start on going into the Grand Prix, just like to start on the, you know, we've been talking about him quite a lot already, but the heartbreak for Vinales going on to the last lap and having a technical issue. And now, I didn't realise, his interview afterwards, he'd actually been struggling with a gearbox issue since lap six. He was struggling to hook sixth gear, constantly going up on the straight. And we couldn't actually see this on the footage, but a few times he said he was hitting the limiter and getting false neutrals and couldn't get it. And he was losing a couple attempts at a time. And he thought that he probably could have won the race, which is amazing. We've not been used to seeing this sort of performance from Vinales. He could have done the double, so he must have been absolutely gutted, Matt.
Yeah, well, if you take that into account and look at where he was when the gearbox finally munched itself, then yeah, there's no doubt he should have been in contention for that win. And this brings up my interesting theory of motorbike aerodynamics, and I need to caveat this with saying simply, I watched a single video on the internet about MotoGP aerodynamics, so I'm not an expert. But watching the races, I did have the question, looking at the performance of the Aprilia, especially in the hands of Vinales, that they don't seem to run a lot of what I would call straight line aerodynamics. You know, the stuff that is pointed like a regular wing when the bike is straight up and down on a flat patch of tarmac. It seems it's all in the fairing. So when you lean, essentially, it's working kind of like a ground effect. And so you would see him in the mid-corner just leave people behind. And then you could see, even from the chasing shots, they have none of like that big KTM massive wing on the rear seat, or even those angle things that the Ducatis like to run. So it's very efficient in a straight line. And I don't know if there's a power unit deficit there, or maybe they want to be able to run lighter on gas. I don't know why they've chosen to go with a narrower profile like that, but that would be my guess. But I would think that maybe the massive elevation changes of this track kind of disadvantaged the other bikes, who depend more on that straight up and down kind of aero to help them in the braking zones and in the acceleration zones.
Maybe. That's an interesting theory. And you could visibly see Vinales through that final corner jumping, gapping the other bikes. And was it Spargaro mentioned this in Qatar? He said it was like a Formula One car through some of the fast corners because the ground effect bearing is really working. Obviously, the other teams are going to be scrabbling to copy this. It's pretty hard with concessions. The Japanese teams can. They have concessions. They can make a few changes this year. But I don't think all the factory teams are pretty much locked into what they've got. I think they can make one change maybe later in the season. But that is very interesting to see it. And yeah, the bikes, how they've evolved over the last couple of years as well. They're looking like more and more like spaceships almost every week, and it's crazy. So yeah, that was really interesting to see how the difference in the bikes essentially, and that ground effect actually working. So the elevation change, I'm not sure whether that would help or hinder them really. It was really quite amazing. What you called a straight line aero, I think that's mainly to help them with the wheelie and yes, stability and braking. So I'd probably like that with the elevation change. Maybe more of that straight line aero could even be an advantage, but hey, that's why we're not aerodynamicists and we don't know. Danny, what's your say?
I was just about to say, I think it's what's really positive is to see that the three main teams are kind of going three different ways when they come into it. Obviously Ducati's got their philosophy, KTM's got their philosophy, and Aprilia's going a different way as well. So it's nice to see that they've not all kind of converged onto the same path and got a bit of a stablemate. So it's really interesting, let alone the riders, to see which bike comes out on top over the season.
Well, and that's the thing. They haven't converged, but we're seeing the kind of sort of circuit-specific performance that suggests that we could have a two- or three-way fight to the end of the season. It's not just going to be Ducatis at the front and everybody else seeing what they can, whatever scraps they can grab. There's legitimately going to be a fight for the front at every race, and we don't know ahead of time, because we're not aerodynamicists, who's going to be winning that fight.
Yeah, and the interesting thing indeed is that it's also going to be track dependent if you follow Matt's theory, because like you said, Kyle, you could, especially also in the sprint, you could see Vinales in that final turn just closing up on Miller in front of him. And while KTM often has this impressive straight line speed, it was just like he was toying with him and just waiting for him to make the overtake. So yeah, it was very, very impressive. And what was maybe even more impressive, the lap times that Vinales was able to do despite this gearbox issue from lap six, he lapped about the same times as Jorge Martin, and he lapped faster during almost all of the race than, for instance, Acosta, who eventually would end up in P3. So I can see why he thought afterwards, like, if I didn't have this issue, I could have won this race, because it's, I don't know how he did it, but his lap times were very impressive.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. That was metronomic. And, you know, Maverick Vinales isn't one, he's not really classed as a dreamer, to be honest. He's usually quite hard on himself. So him sort of saying, I think I could have won this race, it's not him being, you know, Billy Big Spherical Objects saying I could go and do this. This is him like probably being genuine and honest, saying, yeah, I genuinely thought I could. Because, you know, you think if you hit like the rev limiter or you miss a gear at the top thing, you're going to lose at least 2-3 tenths at the very, 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 very least. So that was amazing. And just quickly nipping back to the aero theory before I throw over to Jules, to go back to our aero theories and our different and our different philosophies. One race which I think might really suit the Aprilia if this ground effect really really works, and it's their home race as well, is Mugello. Lots of fast, sweeping, flowing corners. I'm hoping and expecting that bike to be mighty there, Jules.
It could well be, and I was already looking at the elevation map of Coda to see what the elevation there is exactly, because we all know the first turn, of course, on the track. But it has some elevations. Of course, it's a shame Adam couldn't make it on the show today, because he would be able to tell us a lot more about it. But I was just going to say, like, in the end, it was almost fortunate how Vinales eventually was launched by his bike, because he already had that issue on the start finish straight, and then it hampered his speed into that turn one, which he still looked like he wanted to make. But imagine that his gearbox would have jammed in some kind of fast corner, or faster than that, because if you saw the way his bike launched him once it got stuck, it could have been a lot worse.
Absolutely. And it was really quite strange. So I looked into this afterwards. I'm like, what could happen? Because it looked like it had pretty much lunched itself and then just locked and spat him over. But actually what happened, I think he got a false neutral. He couldn't, and he was just clunking down trying to get gears. And so he's basically cruising along with the gears, obviously with the thing. And then all of a sudden, when he's leant over, he was clicking down trying to get second for turn one. It got second, and it was him actually got back on the throttle again. It suddenly engaged second and high-sided him. So it was the opposite. He actually high-sided. But you're right. Even if he was in a fast corner and trying to shift up on the side and gets a false neutral, that will take the load off the front that is going down. Or if he gets an unwanted snap. So yeah, it's so dangerous in MotoGP. So you are exactly right. That could have been so much worse. But how unlucky. He rode, he did absolutely everything right managing this problem, and he got absolutely robbed. But because he was absolutely robbed, that opened the door for one of the sensations of the weekend for me, basically. And that's Pedro Acosta. Oh, my dearie me. What? Like, from being quiet in practice and qualifying and not really setting the world alight in the sprint to setting the world alight during the actual Grand Prix. What an incredible ride. The way he's throwing the bike around. And what this really reminded me of during the whole race as I'm watching this is Marc Marquez in 2013. This is the sort of buzz he had when he was on the Honda. And I remember Marquez, I think it was his like third race in Jerez, and he was like falling back from, I think it was Lorenzo in front. And he just knew, it was like the bike's bucking and weaving. He's getting air under the rear tire going into the braking zones. And you're just like, he's going to try something. You know he's going to try something. And he does. And he just comes from miles back and tries a move. Acosta is giving me all of those vibes. He looks crazy. He looks out of control, but also so in control at the same time. His bike is doing shapes that no other riders are doing, but he's holding it beautifully. And Danny, like, did this give you the same vibes? I'm just seeing, like, you know, we haven't seen a rider cause a stir like this since Marquez, since Rossi.
Yeah, 100%. It is like going back 11 years and watching Marquez when he first burst on the scene in 2013. What's interesting to see is you see riders in the styles, and obviously Marquez come on and everybody raved about his style, how much he hung off the bike, really got the back end out. And then you watch him in the race and he looks quite reserved, and you watch Acosta and he's the one with the back end sliding out everywhere. I mean, I can't remember which lap it was, but he must have got 9,500 degrees out of control. Snapped it back, just stayed on it turn one and carried on. I mean, incredible control on the bike.
I mean, you know, I love this because you see him under braking and you're like, oh, wow, look at that. He's managed to get the rear wheel in front of the front wheel somehow, but he goes around the turn and is ahead of the person he's trying to pass that he just, I don't know, did he even brake for some of those turns, or just like, you know, he whispered slower and then the bike did what it wanted. But what I really love is, like, from having watched the first race in Qatar, it's very clear they just said, here's what we don't want you to do. We don't want you to worry about your tires. We want you to go out there and drive fast and pass people. You're going to figure out the tires. And he did that. And your normal lesson from that, if you're me or just a normal person, your lesson is, okay, I blew up my tires. I have to be more careful. But apparently his lesson was, oh, I can just ride with the tires like that and not worry about the fact that my bike is sideways through half of the turns. It was just astonishing technical mastery. And if I don't care who I am on that grid, I'm looking at that performance, I'm like, ah, geez, I'm going to have to deal with this, aren't I?
Yeah, because people were almost expecting him to eat his tires the way he was riding in the first half of that Grand Prix. And it was almost like, yeah, well, this is just sitting and waiting until his tires are shot and he's going to drop back. But he didn't, and he kept riding these incredible tight turns where all the other bikes were going a bit wide and let it roll with how that turn went. But he was able to stay so tight, and it was like, how, you know? And then, you know, when he was able to attack eventually Bagnaia, and he failed at his first instance. And it's like Matt says, I don't remember. Like, when he has a mistake, it doesn't scare him, or it doesn't turn him off for a bit. Like, oh, I'll better be cautious. But he just keeps on going with what he's doing, and yeah, it's like he looks at the riders in front of him, takes the lessons as they come right away, and picks it up and practices it in the next lap.
You know what really impressed me with him at this race, though? We saw Qatar, and he went from the first lap, gung-ho, burnt his tyres, you know, got his name out there, passed people, dropped back significantly at the end of the race. This race, I actually thought it took a little bit longer to make that break. He kind of sat in, got behind the KTMs, I think it was, saw what they were going to do. I think Miller made a mistake, he went past. And then that was kind of the signal for him to start pushing and go up to the front. And when he went, I don't think he was quite as erratic as he was at Qatar, and clearly he wasn't, because the tyres held in longer. But boy, is he a breath of fresh air, because similar to Marquez, when he first burst on the scene and a couple of other riders, he gets there and you just know he's going to have a go, which is what everybody as a fan wants to see.
Absolutely. And it's not just, you know, just gung-ho shooting from the hip. This kid's got a good brain on him. If you listen to his interview afterwards, and we've alluded to it already here, like when he failed to initially get past Bagnaia, he was actually asked after the race, you know, what are you learning and who you're following? Because he was actually following the KTM guys, you know, who are riding the same bike. And it was, I don't think this is arrogance or like a veiled dig. He was just, yeah, I just passed them. I didn't pay too much attention. It was Bagnaia who I wanted to follow because I know he's really good at looking his tires. So he actually said this, that he didn't really pay much attention to the other KTMs, the factory KTMs, the people who were senior to him in KTM. He just nailed them and just sort of cleared off. And then he sat behind Bagnaia and he said he was trying to see what Bagnaia was doing with his body and how he moved to try and preserve the tires, and then realized that he was faster. So he just passed him and then cleared off, which is amazing. And this goes back to Binder. Binder, he seems like a nice guy as well. Like, Binder was asked about Acosta after this and he had nothing but praise for him. It wasn't embarrassment saying, oh, well, yeah, easy for a rookie to come in and stuff. He was just saying, no, the guy is amazing. He was rolling, he was sliding, he was fast. And he called him, and he said he's very special, and called him a class act. So fair play, Binder. That's good. It'd be interesting to see what Miller wants to say too much about him about mid-season, because I imagine Miller would be feeling very under pressure for his seat. But Danny, if you're one of the other top riders there, you can't help but just take your hat off to him and just say, wow, he's doing such a stunning job. But you're going to be worried, aren't you?
Yeah, 100%. And I think what is good to hear coming from Acosta is that, I know some people will call it really bad arrogance, but name me a great driver, rider, who has ever turned up, who's gone on to be a true great and given any other person respect, kind of even from day one. They've kind of turned up, gone, yeah, they're good drivers, riders, but I'm here to win and I'm here to do my job. And they hit the track, they learn very fast and they've got no fear. And you don't really hear them give everyone a lot of good praise. And Acosta's showing signs of that already. And again, another sign of a great rider is that everybody else is taking notice. If the other riders are noticing and giving him praise, that means really they're worried. That's a telltale sign, isn't it? That they're thinking, uh-oh, this kid is coming.
Yeah, and to add to that, what we referred to earlier in this episode, if you compare him to the other bike, the other GasGas Tech 3 machine, it's nowhere to be found, you know, so it just tells you all you need to know about Acosta.
Yeah, I mean, you look at him and the first thing you think is generational talent. And people call it arrogance, but I don't get the sense of disrespect in terms of like, oh, I have no respect for you. But I just think it's an accurate appraisal. yeah, I followed this guy. I was faster and I went past him. So yeah, maybe they don't respect the quote unquote hierarchy that might or might not exist in this, but it's racing. There is no hierarchy. The hierarchy is fastest wins. That's it. And if you know you're fast and you know you're going to make that pass, then you make that pass. And that's how it works. So I'm very impressed with the maturity I'm seeing out of him at this early stage. That's what I would say.
Absolutely. And yeah, I'll have the final comment on Acosta here, because we've thrown around the word arrogant a few times, but we've not actually called him arrogant, and in no way is he arrogant at all. Like, everyone sees, he seems like a super nice young lad. Everyone in the paddock seems to love him. He's coming out with some, is a brilliant quote machine. I love this one from Qatar, which is just strap your balls on and ride it and off you go, basically, is what he said. He seems like a super intelligent, super charismatic, lovely young lad, and yeah, he's quite matter of fact about it. And like I said, when he said these comments, he was like, yeah, I just sat there and I just passed them. It's not disrespect at all, but when we say respect, you know, usually you'd expect in your debut, you're going around and there's your idol, Marc Márquez, in front. You're like, oh, I'm not going to try a risky move or anything like that. Not Pedro Acosta. he was like, oh, I've got a chance to overtake it. Now I'm going to go out and prove my point. And this is exactly what Rossi did when he came into the championship. This is exactly what Márquez did. And those are some of the best riders of all time. These are all-time greats. Pedro Acosta, in my opinion, has that all-time great quality about him. It's very early days, but you don't see that many riders come in and make a stir quite like this. And particularly this era, it's worth mentioning this era with the tyre pressures problem, with the aero and trying to follow people. This era is harder. It's much, much harder to go and do and stick these moves on. It's becoming a much more processional sorts of races. So to see him still causing the same stir, I'd kind of argue that it's tougher to do that nowadays, and especially with like the limited testing they have, than it was when Márquez and Rossi came in, both of them. So yeah, I expect big things moving on. And if I was KTM, I would be trying to lock him in for a 20-year contract. I'd be like, just sign your life away to us now and we'll give you however much money you want. But talking about really, really good performances and championship contenders, wow, Martin, how dominant was that performance from him? That was amazing. Jules alluded to it earlier with Maverick Vinales' lap times, but yeah, that was a clinical performance. He led every single lap. He looked so happy, and as we mentioned during the sprint review, he was really confident on the medium tire, like really, really confident on the medium tire. So when he got there, he knows he can run his pace, and that must be hard mentally, as also we said earlier, leading the race and just pounding out the laps. The half the battle is in your own head and between the ears and with the concentration. And he seems so comfortable doing this. It was Indonesia, I think, last year when we see him pretty much just dominate and just go around. So it's absolutely crazy performance. And it's kind of good to see, because we know Bagnaia's not going to run off with it. And he was struggling after his mistake in the sprint. But Danny, it's nice to see somebody else who can be that dominant this early in the season. And when we say dominant MotoGP, we're talking about just over a second winning. We're showing how competitive it is.
Yeah, never mind his nickname of the Martinator, I think it is. He should be called the Roadrunner, because every time he hits the front, very rarely do you ever catch up with him. He's just gone. But yeah, super impressive performance. Again, real nice guy. And another one who's deadly, a bit like Bagnaia. They hit the front, and if you don't snap at them quickly to get them out of their rhythm, very Lorenzo-esque as well, they'll just get into a rhythm, consistent, and just ride away. And that's what he did. Absolute pure class up at the front of the field.
Absolutely. And that is a very good nod to Lorenzo, because he was classic and famous for this, just hitting that same lap time, lap after lap after lap. And Martin is very, very good at this, proven map.
Yeah. And this is the learning, maybe even from as recently as the last race of last season, is you sit down and you look at that and you're like, okay, if I want to win a championship, the thing that I got to fix is my own head. I got to always make the smart choice across a whole season that's wildly more competitive than probably anybody anticipated. I mean, you walk into the season, you're thinking, yeah, Martin Bagnaia, and suddenly, like, all of them sticks been thrown up in the air. So the fact that he's making these choices now could wind up being the ultimate difference when we get to December.
That is a very, very good point, because we saw him at the back end of last year. it might have actually been Indonesia when he was dominant in the sprint and then binned it in the race. Which one was that? I can't remember. It might have been Thailand where he was leading the race and he just had the championship lead overnight and then ended up binning it out of the lead when he had a huge lead and didn't need to. And then also the crazy soft tire risk that he took at Phillip Island. Just inexplicably decided to take a risk, whereas now it's like, no, maybe play a bit more of a sensible game. Bit more of a sensible game and let's try and bring it home for this championship. And talking to the championship, he's got an 18-point lead already. That's pretty scary, Jules.
Yeah, and what a switch around from how the weekend started when he had, I'm not sure how many points he was behind, but I think to Benyaya, he has now 25-26 points lead. So it was great for him. And I don't think we would have thought that we would use words like clinical or surgical when it came to Jorge Martin and his riding style. But I looked at his lap chart, and between lap 12 and 24, there were less than 0.2 of a second difference. Wow. Between those lap times. It's just insane how he did that and still lapping the fastest of everyone as well.
Yeah, I think we spoke at the end of last season, didn't we, about Martin. He was very much focused on the sprint, about getting the performance there. He needed to understand how to manage the race slightly better. And I think so far this season, he looks like he's done that because he weren't making many mistakes. He's a bit more cautious going into it, you know, playing the numbers game a bit more. But certainly it looks like he's managed to understand when you're at the front, you manage the race or in what position you are and try and take the actions when they come up and make the right move at the right time.
It's at the end of the day, if you want to win the championship, you have to dispense with your ego. You can't say, I'm not going to let that rookie pass me. I'm not going to let that guy pass me. Because when you do that, you crash. And when you crash, you know what you don't do? You don't score points. It's all about bringing it home as high up as you can across a whole season. And now, yeah, it's only the second race. There's plenty of time for all of this to go sideways for him. I will be happy to admit that we have exactly 2 data points here. But what I've seen so far is an exact reversal of what I saw at the end of last season with Bagnaia and Martin.
Absolutely. And talk about bringing it home and bringing home the points for the championship. 2 people who didn't bring it home and bring home the points for the championship. So we're going to move on to our final topic we're going to discuss then. Bagnaia versus Marquez, both on the deck. Let's just get straight to it. I'm going to go to each one of you. Whose fault is it? Jules, whose fault was it?
To me, definitely Marc Marquez. If you ask me, and you did, I thought if you looked at the gap Acosta was able to pull once he was past Bagnaia, it was clear that Bagnaia didn't have the pace. So for an experienced rider like Marc Marquez, did he need to make such a risky overtaking maneuver that he couldn't really make? Because you can see he runs wide in the turn when he has overtaken Bagnaia, knowing that Bagnaia didn't have to pace. Did he need to be that aggressive, that risky? And you, an experienced rider like him, he should have known that Bagnaia was going to make cut back inside of him, and that he was going to be there. So I didn't understand why he went turned into him so aggressively, and why he did the move in the first place, because there would have been plenty of time with the pace that Bagnaia had.
That is very interesting. I'm going to go to the other two and ask their points of view before coming back to prove why you're wrong. So, Matt, whose fault was it?
Oh, that's entirely on Bagnaia there. There's no doubt in my mind, because I'll start with the fact that Acosta literally made that exact same kind of pass on Bagnaia like a couple of laps earlier. So first of all, I think Bagnaia was entirely on tilt at that point. I don't think he liked Acosta passing him. And God forbid, here comes Marquez, does the exact same thing. And to answer Jules' point briefly, the reason I do believe it was Bagnaia's fault 100% was Marquez was entirely ahead. Why did he cut back that steeply? Because obviously he had to run wide. He knew he wasn't going to have the same amount of exit corner speed that he would have liked if he'd been fully on the racing line. But that is also a classic racing tactic. It's not like he left. If he'd left Bagnaia no room, I think you'd have a point, and I would blame Marquez for that. He left him enough room, but he didn't leave him enough room to complete the corner and have more exit speed than Marquez. And to me, Bagnaia just ignored that and drove directly into him and expected Marquez to just get out of his way because, you know, I'm not going to allow I'm not going to allow two Spaniards to pass me. One was bad enough.
That's good. We've got two different opinions. Danny, whose fault was it?
Can I just start by saying, can I have some of what Jules has been drinking? It'd be pretty good to have. 100% Bagnaia. As much as I know, you know, it's very much split social media when you look on there, but it has to be Bagnaia. I mean, I can't say any more than what Matt said. I think he summed it up beautifully. Yes, it was an aggressive move from Marquez, which you would expect. He left Bagnaia room. Bagnaia was the one what kind of, you know, ran into Marquez at the end of the day. I know Marquez did cut back quite tight, but he's got to make the corner and get a run out of it. But I think, again, what Matt said was really interesting because I do think Acosta coming past kind of lit Bagnaia up a little bit where he thought, oh, here comes the rookie. You quickly glance over your shoulder and you look at your pit board as well and it says Marquez is right on your tail. You know, the two people you probably don't want to see when you're in a race who you know are, whatever happens, are going to have a go at you. And I think you could argue that that was the first sign of the championship pressure starting to get to Bagnaia a little bit because I think if he'd got quite a big lead in the championship with a bit more cushion, I don't think he'd have gone back at Marquez on that. I think because it is close early in the season, he had to try and make a statement that he weren't going to be a pushover, which arguably we've seen him be sometimes in some of the races just because he thinks of the longer game rather than the initial race there and then.
I love it. We've got a split panel. I love it. There's great points from all corners. My personal point of view is, yes, I'd say the blame is predominantly on Bagnaia, but there are mitigating circumstances. I'm semi in the Bagnaia court. I think the race control decision was exactly right for no penalty, and Marquez has actually, fair play, has come out and said that's the right decision. It shouldn't have been a penalty, but he has basically used the word risky, and it was interesting to hear Jules saying that Marquez took a risk with the move, and yeah, it was quite a late lunge, but you know, Bagnaia is the last of the late breakers. It's really hard to outbreak him, so Marquez outbroke him. He goes a bit wide, but this is where I think it's Bagnaia's fault. Bagnaia does, as Matt said, sort of accelerate into him as such. But if you see, Bagnaia had quite a lot of room to the apex. Bagnaia was wide himself, so he was also in semi-hot as well and trying the cutback. So it's a natural thing. I do believe it's mainly a racing incident, but Bagnaia is predominantly to blame. Not enough for a penalty. I think the stewards got it exactly right, but I know it's divisive online. I think there's a hang up from the Rossi versus Marquez sort of fan bases still at each other's throats on Twitter, which is quite sad to see. So yeah, there's lots of people who obviously calling it completely Marquez's fault. Loads of Marquez fans calling it completely Bagnaia's fault. I think it's likely somewhere in the middle, but it's great when we got a split panel and Jules going completely with Marquez because I completely disagree. I can see the side of Marquez taking a slight risk, but he had to do it. As you said, Acosta's gone and Acosta's disappearing up the road. Marquez had more pace and could see Bagnaia was struggling, and Bagnaia said himself he was struggling with pace here. So Jules, are you still going to insist on being wrong?
Of course. I mean, put it the other way. If it was Bagnaia in Marquez's place and the other way around, do you guys think that Bagnaia would have turned in on Marc Marquez in this situation like Marquez did on him? I don't believe it. I think it's like what Bagnaia said afterwards. It's two different riders, two different opinions, and two different mentalities. And I think this was about Marquez wanting to make a point. Marquez is a guy who wants the bike Bagnaia is on. And I think Bagnaia, indeed, I agree with you on that, Kyle, is a rider who knows this is the former ruler of the pack. And I've been a challenger for that throne for the last couple of seasons, and I'm not gonna have him on my bike.
It definitely
that
was
I was gonna say
it was definitely a racing incident at the end of the day. But like you say, it's interesting when you start looking at the difference a bit, because the question you asked, Jules, I actually think Bagnaia wouldn't have tried what Marquez did. I think he would have opened the corner and let him go. So he's very different styles coming at it into the corner.
I mean, to me, as a racer, what Marquez did is a tactic. And I think it was a fair tactic because there was room for Bagnaia to make the corner. because Bagnaia was coming from behind. He could see where Marquez is. He could see where Marquez turned in. And at the end of the day, whatever he expected, he got it wrong and ran into Marquez from behind. So to me, that's what makes it simple. But I do have a question for you, which is, are we seeing the start of a new rivalry in the sport? And is this going to be one of these, oh, you know, we're good friends kind of rivalries? Or is this going to be one of these, we hate each other and fist fights at dawn kind of things?
Oh, Matt, that is a question and a half. That is brilliant. I want to go first on this one. They both keep saying that they're getting on all right with each other. They're both sort of grown-ups. They're both multiple world champions, sort of in their own right. They're both quite sensible. Bagnaia said he's got no problem with Marquez. Marquez has said he's got no problem with Bagnaia. Marquez was quite keen to point out that it was Bagnaia's mistake. He said he knew what he did. He knew the mistake he made. He was quite keen, whereas Bagnaia was quite keen just to say it's a racing incident. And in Bagnaia's defense, when you're hanging off the inside of the bike, you can't see what's going on the outside. He assumes, so you're making a rough assumption when you're going. So in Bagnaia's defense, he couldn't really see where Marquez was when he chose to cut back. So once you've already done that, you've already made that choice. So I don't think that's on him too much. But yes, I truly believe in Matt. I think this is going to brew into a rivalry, Danny, because, well, Pecco's the big boy in Ducati, and he's had the annoyance, the uncle who should have retired, or the uncle come in, got on the same bike, a bike not as good as him, who is now trying to overtake him to finish ahead to get his ride. Yeah, Danny, I think they're going to be rivals. What about you?
Yeah, and let's face it, at the end of the day, everybody's sick of hearing the commentators say, oh, the riders get on, they're all kind of good friends. We love a bit of niggle. Let's get some niggle on this grid and get some, I wouldn't say animosity, but let's get a bit of a story going on. They don't like each other. It's rubbish when everybody gets on and, oh yeah, well done, mate. Yeah, really well done. No, let's get some handbags throwing in the Parc Fermé, you know, coming out in the press saying they're going to whop them and that when they get to the race. That's what we want to see. So a few more incidents like I'll do me for the season, and let's get some niggle into the story.
I don't think, as much as I'd like to see it, even though as much as they're going to be rivals, I don't think they're going to be too much niggle. I think Marquez should know better by now. After his run-ins with Rossi, he's learned his lesson. He can't be bothered with any more sort of fierce rivalries. And Bagnaia seems a bit too much of a placid character for it. But I don't know. Let's see. He goes, I wouldn't object if they both get each other's throats. But it's only race two and they've bumped into each other already. I expect this is going to be happening again and again and again, hopefully. I think we're in for a rip snort of the season. Jorge Martin certainly praying that it's going to happen again, because Bagnaia is now 23 points off the lead of Martin and Marc Marquez is 33 points off the lead. That's quite a significant margin, even at an early stage, with 25 going for a race win. And talking about 25, that may definitely not be the amount of money I put on Marquez to win the championship. So I'm hoping he's not that far off the lead, because I have a sneaky bet on Marquez. But Matt, do you want full beef or gentlemanly races?
Okay, so here's the thing. If I'm watching, yeah, and you're talking to someone who watched Muhammad Ali in his prime, there is nothing I love better than the pre-fight verbal fisticuffs, the ramping it up to 37. That's fantastic. What worries me about it is the legions of people online who won't appreciate it for what it is and will take it far too seriously. And we have seen this in other sports. It's not something Absolutely. I want to see in this sport. So do I want it? Yes. But if the cost is going to be that same level of online animosity and just, can I just say, just sheer stupidity, then no, actually, I kind of would rather them just leave it be, and I'll sit sadly with my loss for the civilization I once knew and think about what might have been, just to spare myself the ridiculousness of the online keyboard warriors.
That's a great point and very well said. Hear, hear. One solution was we could just grenade Twitter, and just if we kill Twitter, it's the problem over. But that's the thing. But dear Danny, I have been annoyed with some of the comments I've read about this, and people are so tribal and divisive already about it. And I'm just like, can't everyone get on? They're all heroes, in my opinion. I don't want to take sides in this particularly. But it's a shame, isn't it, when you see people making ridiculous comments and calling other riders the devil and whatnot.
It is, and I agree with Matt. I mean, the other sport he's talking about is clearly cricket or something. So I just want to make sure that's clear where it's gone down, Pam, really fast. But yeah, it's just, unfortunately, it comes with the territory, doesn't it? We have seen it in other sports, and it takes it from a healthy debate where you can have a bit of banter and throw a few light insults forward and back. But yeah, certainly we don't want to see in it. It certainly ruins some of the other sports we are watching. So, you know, yes, get a bit of niggle, but let's take it for what it is. It's a bit of entertainment at the end of the day and nothing toxic between everybody.
Okay, so before we go, there is a name that has not been mentioned here, but you talked about the battle for the Ducati top seat with Marquez and Bagnaia. But he's not the only rider, Bagnaia, on that team. Bastianini, who had a terrible last year because of his injury, I think this might also, is this possibly part of the explanation why Bagnaia is suddenly like, oh, geez, yeah, maybe I need to be more definitive here because like my teammate is suddenly looking better than me. And that didn't happen last year very often, did it?
No, that is an amazing point because, yeah, Bastianini was nailed. I can't remember who harpooned him now. He was taking out quite hard in this race last year and completely screwed his shoulder up really badly. So that was terrible. But yeah, it is worrying for Bagnaia that his teammate is now outperformed him almost this weekend. And yeah, Bastianini come through to almost a stealth second. You can kind of say he was looking really, really strong and he was in there. And he was really unfortunate actually in the sprint race. He made a mistake. He held his hands up and owned it. But when he was loading his hole shot device where they collapsed the front suspension running up to the grid, he hit the brakes a bit too hard, which then unloaded the front and it disengaged just before the start. So he disengaged his front hole shot device, lost loads of positions and ended up just getting stuck in sixth place and couldn't go forward. So he had really good pace. So that, thank you, Matt, for bringing that up. And yeah, Danny, how could we forget about the Beast, one of your favourite riders?
Well, that's it. It was interesting as well, like you said, because I hadn't heard the brakes one. I know Hodgie on the commentary said what actually happened. He got to the grid, he pressed the button, it had engaged, but he weren't too sure if it had engaged or not. So he pressed it again, and then that was what released it. And obviously away they went. But yeah, I think he had a really solid weekend, really good to see. I am a big fan of him, mainly because his helmet's cool, if I'm honest. I absolutely love his helmet. It just looks incredible, the mouth there as well. But yeah. What can I say? Great guy, great result. Hopefully he keeps it up for the rest of the season. And hopefully he does put Bagnaia under a little bit of pressure as well. It'd be good to see how he responds.
Yeah, so that's a kind of a good way to almost wrap up the Bagnaia-Marquez thing. I don't think we're quite done, though, because you've got Gigi Lagna, you know, the guy who's running Ducati essentially there, has been quite conscious with his choice of words not to sort of spark the rivalry. And he actually escorted both of them into race control to sit down, basically to talk about it. And yeah, they both agree, you know, that it was mainly a racing incident, although Marquez did say it's Bagnaia's fault, but a penalty wouldn't be deserved, which is good. But Gigi Delania, yeah, he's now got a problem on his hands, and he was always going to have this problem as soon as he put Marquez on the Ducati, because, yeah, he needs to keep his number one rider, Bagnaia. You want to keep him sweet. But he's going to be coming under all sorts of pressure, especially if Marquez gets stronger and stronger throughout the season, which I truly believe he will. He's surely going to come under pressure to put Marquez into that factory team. And if Bastianini's performing as well, he's got a major, major problem on his hands now. So I would not like to be in his shoes. He's got a nice problem. He's got great riders. But if this brews and gets toxic, Danny, this is going to be fascinating to see how this plays out.
Yeah, you could argue that actually he's who's at fault for the collision, because he's kind of signed off Marquez coming into the team, and you knew there were going to be fireworks when you bring a big dog into the team and everybody's fighting for that top ride. So yeah, going to be interesting to see how he deals with it. I think he's been very good at rider management over the last couple of seasons, but I think this could be a bigger task than what he expected it were going to be. But yeah, actually thinking about it, I think he's probably at fault, because now he's got the egos in one area all fighting it out for the same prize.
A left field crazy conspiracy theory is a good way to end this debate. I like it. So then to wrap up, we like to give out a couple of awards. So at the end of the at the end of sort of the race reviews, I like to ask the panel and myself, who was your rider of the weekend? So I'll go to you first, Danny. Danny, who was your rider of the weekend and why?
Oh, it's interesting because I don't want to nick everybody else's. There's a few clear choices to take. But actually, looking back on it, I think I'm going to go for Vinales. I think he did a really solid result, was excellent in the sprint. And obviously, that's just stole someone else's choice. Did a really good solid in the sprint race, was good in the main race. And like I say, it's heartbreak when you see him have the error at the end of the race as he was going through. But hopefully that'll put him on a good course for the season. It'd be nice to see him get some solid results. I don't think he's going to win the championship, but I think over the whole weekend, he was the rider that impressed me the most and on a constant basis, should I say. Obviously, Acosta was very good as well, but Vinales for me.
That's hard to argue, and that was my one. So I'm going to go to Jules next while I try to think of another one.
You guys kind of already stole mine as well with your compliments for Enea Bastianini just yet. But I was going to nominate him, La Bestia, the Beast. He went missing for a lot of last season while he actually had a really good season prior to that. And it wasn't all to his fault. And it almost seemed like Pecco Bagnaia last season didn't have a teammate. And now the way he started this season, two front row starts in Qatar and now in Portugal. And especially, he was unlucky on Saturday indeed, but if you saw him ride the Grand Prix on Sunday, it was spotless and almost as fast as Jorge Martin. So yeah, I agree with Danny. I'm really curious to see what his role is going to be in all this Ducati violence between Marquez, Bagnaia, and also Martin, undoubtedly. So yeah.
Cool. That's another good one. Matt, who is your rider of the weekend and why?
Well, this seems unfair because we have at least three riders left to choose from. So you're going to get multiple choices to mention everybody. And this is like, it's hard for me. You got Vinales, Bastianini. And who am I going to pick now? But you know who I'm going to pick? Acosta. I just got to give him the nod here. As much as I also want to pick Marquez and whoever on the Yamaha scored the points, I'm going to go for Acosta because for a rookie in their second race to be doing that, that's just a little special. Just a little special. He won't always have these performances. He's still young. He's still learning. But what he did this weekend demonstrates what he's going to be all about when he masters his craft. And that's going to be something special to watch.
I'm not sure I can agree with a comment any more than that. That was my backup after Vinales because I was assumed that somebody was going to take Acosta. So it comes to my rider of the weekend and Rye, and I'm going to go for Jorge Martin then because that was dominant, metronomic in the race and takes quite a healthy championship lead. So there we go. So we now will move on to our moment of the weekend, guys. So I'm going to go first on this one so nobody can steal mine. This is my moment of the weekend turned into moments of the weekend, and that's Acosta's multiple sideways moments. I love watching him chuck that bike and back it into the corners, and it's quite now, unfortunately, it's a bit of a rare sight in MotoGP of someone getting that out of shape on corner entry. Throwback to Marquez when he came in here, and a long throwback to those long-watching fans back to the Red Bull Yamaha days of Gary McCoy going sideways into the corners. It gave me sort of a flashbacks of that, so I absolutely love that. Jules, what was your moment of the weekend?
I picked a sad moment of the weekend, and that was Luca Marini crossing the checkered flag on the 17th position, only Morbidelli behind him, but that's because he crashed, and Marc Marquez, who also crashed, actually finished in front of him. He was about 40 seconds down, and it was the second weekend in a row where he finished all races, bar the crash riders, in last position. And he just looks not only lost, but so slow on the Honda. I mean, we talk a lot about riders like Marquez needing to adjust to a Ducati or a new bike. This is the pole sitter of the penultimate Grand Prix of last season. He had a double podium in Qatar over there. And just now, he's so slow. He was the only rider, just like last race in Qatar, who couldn't set a lap time at least a second. He was a second slower than anybody else, and it's just amazing. They did a test before this race in Jerez, I think, and he crashed there, and it just, he must be so unlucky with his situation right now.
I agree. It's sad to see. So, Danny, what was your moment of the weekend?
See, I actually thought I was stealing yours with this one, but clearly I'm not. So I'm going to go for the Marquez overtake on Vinales in the sprint. Incredible overtake. Thought it was great. So I clearly stole someone else's on the panel. But yeah, brilliant. Mainly because it shows he's starting to get more comfortable with the bike, and a comfortable Marquez who's willing to have a go is what we all want to see.
Can't argue with that. So Matt, Danny's just cold-heartedly stolen yours at the last minute. Do you have a moment of the weekend, a backup moment of the weekend?
Yeah, I do. And like Jules, I'm not going to focus on the positive here. Although if I did, I'd mention the Acosta overtake on Bagnaia. And I'm going to go with the Bagnaia just riding off the course in the sprint. Because to me, that has kind of set the tone for this season. It was unexpected. No one expected to see him do that. And it just suggests to me that there are larger, deeper forces at play here that's going to make this championship one of those ones that we're going to be talking about 10 or 15 years from now, because so many people might be able to win it.
Yep, and that is a very good point to end on. Please, thank you very much for my panel for joining us. Please follow them on the socials. So, Danny, where can people find you?
I'm on Twitter, which is always eventful, at DannyHenneyF1. If you want to give me a follow, you can do. I'm on there now and again. But yeah, that's where you can find me.
Cool. Jules, where can people get hold of you?
Also on Twitter, and it's just at Jules Seegers.
Lovely. And Matt, where can people get hold of you?
I am at MattPT55 on pretty much any social platform you would care to mention, which would include Twitter and all the other ones, except for, I will be honest, I do not have a TikTok.
Nor do I, because I think I'm too old for it. So you can follow me at KylePowerF1 on Twitter. You have been listening to Mist Apex MotoGP podcast review of the Portuguese Grand Prix. The next race is in Cota in 3 weeks' time on the 14th of April. So we'll be back then for another race review. Thank you very much for listening, and we'll catch you in the next one.